1993. Interview with Doug Dawson at the Adams House. October 28th, 1993. Interview with Doug Dawson at the Adams House.
You can say anything you want. You can edit this. But I thought I'd ask you about early years. What I have to say isn't that much of a consequence. I just want to get what you were not. So you kind of say whatever you feel like saying.
We arrived here in 1941 in October.
Uh-huh.
My dad had a job at the Bank of Kodiak at that time, which is now NBA. He had had previous experience in a bank in Seattle, which had connections with this bank here. And then moved back to Montana. And then they decided to come up for a year or two to Kodiak because he'd had hard times getting a job back there in Montana. It wasn't too easy in the early 40s for lots of jobs. Not too awful long after the Depression. We came up on a steamship. My father had arrived several months earlier, and we were very fortunate in the fact that we had a house to live in. Some families lived in basically a tent down by where the city market is today.
So
there were people that built kind of a platform and a frame, and then they put a tent over the top part of the frame, so you had a 8 by 10, or I don't know what the sizes were. They weren't very large, but you know, a couple of people or so could stay in the place.
Were there a lot of people in those tents?
No, seems to me there were about three or four of those that were in that area. Two kind of side by side, and a family moved out, went out on the boat that we came in on. And so we were fortunate for that situation, maybe because I don't remember the details, but possibly because my father had come up ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And made possible.
So he arranged it.
So he arranged it, but I don't know if the bank had anything to do with it or not.
Well, maybe if you would all come up together, you might have been living in the tent.
Maybe. Yeah. But anyway, he worked at that for a while, then changed to other jobs and ended up working for the civil service and the naval base. But it was still a naval base.
What, you said jobs were hard to get. It wasn't that hard to get a job in Kodiak then? Or did it just happen to be an opening?
It just happened to be an opening, and because of its connections with when they worked in the bank in Seattle earlier, then they had that available.
Were there other banks in town, or was that?
No, it was the only bank.
Okay.
And there were basically two doctors at the time, a Dr. Jones and A. Holmes Johnson, Dr. Bob's father, and they had the hospital over where the mental health center is now.
That's and the white building on the channel?
Yes. And so that was a good thing in that time, to have a hospital with actual beds and things. A couple of years later, I'm not sure the exact sequence of time, but we had the Grey Nuns that came and staffed the hospital for many years.
How many people do you remember, or have an idea how many people in Kodiak then? And
I would imagine it was around 1,400-1,500 at the time. I remember some years later, the population was around 1,700, so we had grown a little bit during those years. We had basically one first grade, one second grade on through, so all the students knew each other from early on. I was seven when we came, so I was in second grade. And we were located in an area that's down where the apartments are, next to the old Dr. Bob's clinic, and the alcoholic places.
I don't know.
And that whole area has completely changed. In fact, most of the area of Kodiak that was there when we first arrived is gone because of the subsequent tidal wave and the damage that was done. They then decided to go along with the urban renewal project, and so they basically leveled almost all the downtown Kodiak.
Wow, are there any landmarks?
There are a few structures that were still in existence. Now, next down to the Wallinger Drugstore is the building that has the children's, I guess it's not necessarily children, but all those various pinball machines,
mm-hmm.
games. That was a Kodiak commercial building before.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And that was built, and that was. But the only building in that area that was still kept.
And then the buildings that are built onto it, were those added, or that was part of it?
Well, if you look, there's a, it's part of it, it's a liquor store there, and several other things that are all part of it. It's a big concrete block building.
It's all the same building.
It's all the same. But everything else on up the other side, the Breakers Bar, and
mm-hmm.
the apartments and everything are all new. But because of the tidal wave, the whole area had settled, and at high tide that region would be flooded. And so they filled in a great deal and leveled it out, and then also straightened out all the streets. Look at old Kodiak pictures, the main street of downtown wandered quite a bit. Not straight at all. The only straight street is basically the one that comes up from where the ferry docks. It comes up that way. So those buildings.
That's Center Street now?
Yeah. Where the museum is on the one side and
mm-hmm.
now the other side where the Native Association, which was one at Kodiak, I guess, has that, or Canada. And that area used to be our post office.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
So that has been kept,
mm-hmm.
but that's about it. Everything else has been changed. And so Kodiak had kind of an interesting, picturesque charm in their earlier days. If you remember seeing movies of the old westerns where they had this kind of a square, false front of the
mm-hmm.
building, almost half or more of the downtown buildings had that kind of a facade. And then the pitch roof behind it.
Hmm.
And so, and as I say, it wound around. Of course, the streets were dirt in those early days, and we had board sidewalks.
It's like a western town.
Kind of like a western town, and when it got wet, it got very muddy. And so, many years later, in the late 40s, came in 41, in the late 40s they started paving the downtown area. And so that in itself was quite an event, just to see them paving the sidewalks and the main street downtown Kodiak. That's something that people came up and watched because it was an event. And we didn't have any telephones to speak of. Of course, there weren't many people outside of the area of downtown Kodiak, and then people living out along Mission Road. And only about halfway out along Mission Road were there a number of houses.
How about along Mill Bay Road? The people
there, there were very few, hardly any people that they died on there. There were a couple of houses there. Out by where St. Mary's is, they have. There's a house there that the sisters live in, and that house has been there a long time. There's a family called the Hollands. There were three boys. One was a little younger, myself, and the other two were older, and the only one's living today. The oldest of the brothers. They had a kind of like a homestead out there. And so, like, I think they were the ones that sold it to the work in the church property.
Hmm.
So that was about one of the only places along the way, and there were a couple of places along side of what they called, we called Big Lake. Now they have a different name for it because we had, that's where we used to go swimming for all the float planes. Lily Lake.
Lily Lake.
Yeah. And so that's changed too. All the houses on either side now. There just wasn't anything. There was an area along the edge of the lake, was kind of a clearing where we would come and congregate and build our fires and keep going during the time of swimming, although we didn't really need it. We started one anyway. It was tough. Just kind of fun. So the town was really quite small, even though we did have two drugstores, Wadlinger's and another drugstore called Burt's, which is eventually taken over by Wadlinger's. And they kept both of them open for a while, but they closed the one. They had two movie theaters, the Orpheum, which is still in operation, under different ownership in those days, and another one called the Lyric Theater. Lyric Theater burned down one night, so that was the only one. But we were able to get most of the movies fairly quickly. It wasn't a terribly long time to get some of the movies. So that we were able to keep up with most of the things. And actually in those days, it was a lot different than it is today, because it was more of an event. You could go to the movie and see the newsreel, then the cartoon, then the movie. We didn't have the cartoons, there wasn't a movie as far as I was concerned. Didn't matter how good the movie was, if you didn't have a cartoon, it just took some of
the. Do you remember a movie from back in your childhood that made an impression?
The one that was, that keeps being released from time to time, called Fantasia, by Walt Disney. Now they have it on the videotape. But they put it out, and that was not too long after it originally came out. And I remember being impressed by that. And then, of course, The Wizard of Oz came. And that was a good film to see. Now again, that came out in 39, and so it took a little while to get here. So we saw quite a few other things, but just on a delayed basis.
What about the road, Doug? Out toward the, how far did the road go? Reznov goes all the way out now. Yeah. Was that there? Or?
Well, the military built, of course, out at both points of what is Abercrombie now and Spruce Cape. And they had installations on either place. So a road went out to the end of Spruce Cape, but from not from the way you go now, but from the other side, from the Mill Bay side. Two brothers had come here many years ago, Solberg brothers, and they had homesteaded. One of them homesteaded the area around Island Lake, and so they had, I think they each were given 160 acres, and then the area around Spruce Cape was given to the other brother. He filed for it, and they eventually, of course, sold those two pieces to other people. But the road went through what is all those new houses going out there to beyond Knockway's house, and Gene Irwin stays there now. And if you notice,
that's Woodland Drive.
You know, I don't. I guess that's Woodland Drive.
Woodland Drive, yeah. It was along the inside Mill Bay.
But if you go along there on the one side, you'll see that the road is closed off.
And it's got a gate.
It has a gate there because of the military. That road was the one that they accessed to get out to Spruce Cape.
So, it's the same road there then, the one, yeah. One we would call Woodland Drive now. It's a dirt road off.
Yeah. And then on the other side, of course, was Abercrombie. And that was a larger installation. They had more facilities there. And they had at least one big gun, which is they have a kind of a simile of that now at the site.
Wait, so there wasn't a road there before the military came in?
No. Road basically ended at what is Mill Bay. So that was the end of it. And then, of course, the military built the road out to Chiniac.
And there wasn't any road there?
There wasn't any road there.
When was that, do you remember?
Not for sure. I do remember, though, that earlier on in the early 40s, we were able to go on the road. They had to check through all kinds of gates to get on and go through the military. And then we went out beyond the area of what is now Bell's Flats area, and on the far side, just before you start going up that fairly gradual incline, there was another gate. So you check through in the gate, which is located just at the end of the road before you start, when you go along the road up going toward the base until you end up leaving the coastal area where you can see the water and just start coming up to the one area, and then that was a gate there. And so you had to check in. The Marines were the ones that manned the gates, and then they gave you so much time to get from there to the other gate. And there was plenty of time, so and they didn't want you wandering around the base itself, either during the wartime or particularly, and that was pretty well closed off during that time, so it wasn't really open to the public until after the war, 1945.
Do you remember the military coming, or were they here when you got here?
They had a small amount of people here, but not any large number. They built that up during after the war broke out. So we arrived in October, and the war broke out Sunday on the 7th of December, 2 months after we were here. But they did evacuate some people. We were not evacuated.
Do you remember how people reacted to that here?
Well, we were all surprised and shocked, naturally. And the first thing they did was had an air raid practice that night. The lights were turned off. That was fairly easy to do in those days because the electrical power was basically a large generator in the back of a truck down and near what is now the oil company there next to the ferry dock. They had a lot of dock facilities there that are all completely gone. They were all wiped out with the tidal wave. And so
that was the generator for the whole town?
That was the generator for the whole town. So not everybody had electricity either. And during those years, we knew when the power was about to be turned off. It usually was turned off at, I think, 9 o'clock. So you'd have to get out your lanterns or candles or whatever you used, and they would flick a switch and the light would flicker, and so you knew you had 5 or 10 minutes to get ready for the other thing, and then they hit the switch and all the power was off. And they did have people that first night going around and checking to make sure that everybody's windows are properly sealed so no light would escape, to give the Japanese an indication that anybody was here.
So people really felt that the Japanese might come here?
There was a possibility of a bit of a fear. They did eventually arrive on the islands out on the end of the chain at Tuwakisco, occupied them for a while. They did make a run on Dutch Harbor area, drop a bomb or two. After Mrs. Fletcher, who was one of the brother's sons, runs the theater downtown, was there at that time. She has some pictures of one of the Japanese Zeros that was shot down.
Hmm.
one of his sons brought her to class years ago and teaching history in that period. And so we were prepared for war. Most everywhere else, everybody rationed, had ration cards and things of that nature. We didn't have that because we were, I guess, in a different area. But naturally, there were supplies of that were limited to certain items, but we didn't suffer a great deal during that time. But, you know, I used to get by.
Did the military, did the soldiers stay pretty much out on the base, or were they in town a lot?
Well, they were allowed to come into town, but they weren't allowed to take any liquor back. They tried to control that a great deal. And I remember some of the people that we got to be friends with, they would strap bottles to their ankles, flat bottles usually, and other things, and try to sneak them on board the base. I don't know how successful they were, but they were trying that on a fairly regular basis. And so coming to town was primarily to more than anything else, I think, was just to get some alcohol to drink in the many, many bars we had downtown. Most of the bars that are in existence today were in existence in those days in different settings, different places.
When the military came, did that give a lot of business to the bars, or they were already there?
They were already there, but of course it increased their sales quite a bit. They just had that control on them. At various times, they had quite a few. Hank Eaton has written some historical articles during that time, because he was older and more experienced and directly involved in a lot of that. He has quite a few interesting stories to tell about that. More of the details. This was something of a staging ground for some of the activities that were going to go on further up in the chain. And so some of the people were bivouacked here in a sense. And basically where most of the old housing is located is where the original military, the army, were located.
Are you talking about the base? Or?
Yes. You see, they had the naval base was kind of a separate entity in a sense. Mm-hmm. They had the naval base, and then they had the runways, which are pretty much the same runways that they have now, although they've increased them in length and more. And then they had a couple submarines out there. I'm not sure all the details. We weren't very much into that because it was pretty restricted to the civilians. But they did have things that they set submarine nets and things out across from the base out toward, you know, toward the island that would hopefully catch any submarines that were trying to come through or sneak in there. And out beyond the base, in one of the bays out there, they set up a bunch of lights, little boxes, and would turn those on at night. The idea, if the Japanese popped out of the clouds, there would be this nicely laid out city, and they would bomb that and just wipe out all those light bulbs, and the town would be safe.
Decoy
black gun, so it was a decoy. We did have two alarms during those years that I remember, where we went up to the hills and stayed for the all clear signal.
What triggered the alarms? Were they practice, or maybe there was a plane?
There are rumors about the vessels or a submarine or an airplane popping out of the skies, and I don't know how accurate they were. I just remember hearing that I'd spotted some kind of a ship, and that was one of the reasons for one of them. The other one was there was some kind of a Japanese zero that, the way I heard it, it popped out of the clouds from heavy overcast, and it just kind of appeared there it was. And indications were that the Japanese pilot might have been just as surprised as anybody else and got back out for cover.
Oh, okay.
So that it may have been scouting, we don't know. Those are rumors that may have some real validity to them. But other than that, there wasn't any real extensive alarm. Just that, of course, people occasionally come back, men that come back with their wives, although there was one couple that were married here in the church. That was the only Protestant church at the time, Unity Baptist Church, and he was stationed over on Long Island, but because she was military, she had to leave, and so they were just married and left. But they came back about 2 summers ago just to try to remember all that, and unfortunately almost all of the downtown area is gone. I think I remember the only thing they could relate to was the Orthodox Church is, oh, that's a new church since they were here too. That burned down in the 40s and was rebuilt. And then the museum, which was a private home at the time, belonging to the people that had a store called the Erskines. And so those are things that were just not all that they could remember, and of course the church and the hill, everything else is just all gone.
Yep. So. Doug, now we have fishing, we have all kinds of fishing. What was the main industry back then? Was it fishing or was it something?
It was salmon fishing during the summer. And so that's what everybody kind of depended on. They had a fairly large cannery working down on what is the city dock now. And they had quarters. No, that's not there anymore. Since then, other companies have facilities down there.
What was the name of that?
I don't remember what the name of it was now. Down where the ferry dock is located, they had Whitney Fidalgo company that located there. And a lot of people worked there, more than out at the other place. Out was the city dock where the sea land and all those boats come in. That area was where the Alaska Steamship Company service was provided to. We didn't have any plane activities in those days, no airlines came in, just the military.
So when you came up on the steamship, is that where you came?
Yeah, so everybody arrived, and of course that was an event. Once a week, one of the ships would come in. They had three different ships that came in. Came back and forth between here and Southeastern and over to Homer. And so that people would often go down to the dock just to see who was coming or going. And that was also where a bulk of our mail came in those days too, from the Alaska steamship. So there were a lot of people after the war especially that took round trips. It brought passengers as well as brought freight. And that was our, in a sense, our only connection with the outside world in the early 40s was just through the Alaska Steamship Company. And then they went out of business eventually, primarily because of competition with Sealand. They ended the passenger service and still did the freight for quite a few years, up until the late 50s, I think it was, when they found it. And early 60s, sometime in the 60s now.
What about the population and the people? Were there more
native people here and there, or in the salmon industry, lived in town?
No, they really didn't make up any real significant portion of the population. Naturally, because there was a smaller community at that time, that made up a larger percentage of the population than they do now. But I'm not sure what the exact percentages were between the two groups. Just know when you went to school, I don't remember any real serious discrimination between the native kids and the white kids, or whatever you wanted to call them. They were just your friends in school, because as I said, you went from the first grade on through, and everybody was just all in the same class, and we just grew up with them, and that was the way it was. I had no difficulties of getting along with any of them, other than the fact that you have any rivalries with any other kids your age. None of the classes were terribly large in the early days. And so they had the grade school upstairs, and then down on the lower part of the building, which was not a complete two-story structure, they had the junior and senior high.
Is this building still here?
No, it's gone. And so the other areas where they had to enlarge, as the school got larger, they brought in Quonset huts and put them around the perimeter of the building and used those. And so we kind of outgrew ourselves, and then eventually they built what was the main elementary, now basically the junior high, but some of the elementary in there still. And that was built in several stages. So they had the two schools. Then naturally everything grew. In those early days, we also had a school out at the base. Not right during the first years of the war, everybody came into town. But after the war, the base had its own high school. And so we had a friendly basketball rivalry between the two. And they had a gym out at the base, which has been there most of the time since we arrived. And that's where we played our basketball games against the Navy teams. All these different units out of the Navy base had their own teams. Some of them were college players too, of course. So our high school kids played against some pretty good ball players. So we played in the league and included in that, of course, the high school from the base.
Is basketball the same then as it is now, or?
Oh, in many ways, I think it's pretty much the same. Just like everywhere, the boys are taller than they were. Just only boys, no girls. Girls didn't come until many, many years later. And when the girls first started playing, they played by a different system. And it was much more static and slow and not very interesting to watch. So that change came about in the 70s when they changed from the old format of having three girls on one side of the court and two on the other. And three on the offense and two on the defense. The way they worked it out. And so the girls didn't go back and forth all of them. They came down.
Well, they didn't have to run much.
They didn't have to run as much. And of course their skill levels were not very good because they had never been encouraged to play it at an early age like they do now with the little groomers.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember one year, 1952, that was the year I graduated from high school. That year, the Navy, the base team, beat us in one of the regular games during our season, if you could call it that. And that was really quite an event. They had a photographer come down and take an official team picture. And that, when we went up to the tournament, which is in Fairbanks that year, and they had Class A tournament with Anchorage and Fairbanks and some of the larger schools. Palmer was one of the largest schools at that time. Then they had the B League, which included Kodiak, and Seward, and Nome, some other smaller schools, and of course the base team. We got first, the Kodiak boys got first, and the base team got second. And then the Kodiak town team got the sportsmanship trophy, so we got all the trophies.
Cleaned house that
as
year.
As well as almost all of the All-Stars.
Well,
three or four, I think, of our boys were All-Stars, and two of their team were All-Stars that I remember, at least two, maybe one. So Kodiak really cleaned up. But it wasn't too many years after that when they brought them all together into one high school. And so when I graduated, there were 14 of us in the graduating class, 1952, and there were about 60 students in the high school. But they had 40 or more off the base, and so when the two schools finally came together, then that almost doubled the population that was in high school, over 100. That was sometime in about the mid-50s, I think. I was going to college at the time, so I don't remember much of the details of that.
Doug, I'm wondering about the war. Change during the war? Did they have to assume different responsibilities? Or?
Well, some of them naturally did. That was a major problem. Kodiak didn't seem to be as much affected by it. A lot of the women, the only occupation they really could have at that time, other than working at the stores, was working in the canneries. There just wasn't any other work available. And so they did have, I don't know how many women they had out of the base working out there at that time. Probably not a large number. Most likely would have been military people. I don't think they were going to have too many civilians out in the base during the war years itself. But the fishing went on during those years. The older men, of course, were, some of them were still running the boats. And the young people had gone off to fight their active things. So. But we did have a Filipino bunkhouse, basically down about where the bank is located today, the NBA bank. And they would come up only during the summer because that was the only time there was any work. And it was just the men that came up to work in various jobs that they'd come back for year after year. And then once the fishing began to diversify, then more people came, and more boats came, and everything changed there. But the women did have certain responsibilities, running the stores, and then my mother was involved with various activities before she got involved in the school system. And so she was a manager of one of the stores for a while. And we probably weren't as affected by that, like people working in factories and things elsewhere. They say that a lot of the women worked in the, you knew them as you'd go down and look in the canneries there. In those days, it was not too difficult just to go down on tours and look through the cannery when they were operating, and in the summer only too.
The canneries didn't run during the winter time because they were just salmon canneries.
Of course, they did go out for halibut, but that was primarily by boats that came out of Seattle. So there weren't many local people that did much halibut fishing. These seemed to be of Scandinavian descent, mostly apparently Norwegians, that had a kind of a tradition out of the Seattle area that would come up with these boats. And they would get ice and things from us here, and occasionally would put some out here, and they would ship it down in Sealand, Alaska steamship. And that was probably a lot of it was sent back, and then of course they went back in the full load too once the season was finished. And I don't remember how long they were up here for. I don't think it was a terribly long time. But they would come up every year, do their bit, and head on down. It was in the 50s that they began to experiment with the king crab. Of course, they'd known the king crab was here all this time, but they weren't sure what kind of a commercial value it had.
Did local people eat it?
Yes. But not in any great quantities. It became a delicacy of sorts more during the 50s. And it was more of a kind of a curiosity because they were so large, some of the really big king crab especially. There were photographs that were made of them, or people holding out one to give you an idea of the size of it, kind of like a big spider. And that was probably as much of the interest in the king crab in those days, it was just that large creature. The child, you know, could stretch out its arms from one end to the other and not even always hold on it from end to end. And so then they began to develop an interest in the technique for catching them significant numbers that would be commercially feasible. And once they developed some ideas and worked out the problems, then of course it became a huge industry. That became the major industry for a while because there was so much money in it. And I guess no one really knows even today why it died out in this area. Overfishing is probably part of it, but there seems to be a lot of other factors tied in too.
You mentioned something, Doug, about the young men going off to the service, fighting the war. Did basically all the young men, you know, that were the right age, go off? Or?
Oh, I imagine quite a few.
Were they conscripted or drafted, they volunteered? Or?
They were drafted, or either drafted or volunteered, like Dr. Bob. He was of that age, and so he went into the Merchant Marine. Emil Norton was drafted, and he served overseas in Italy and some other places.
Mm-hmm. Rudy Lawrenson served, he was here, wasn't he?
There were quite a few that served in kind of a scout program.
Mm-hmm.
And since they were familiar with the area, they worked on kind of like a patrol system. That was also true off in the chain. Well, they did relocate a lot of the natives out in the chain itself. And that was in itself a real tragedy because it was not done well. And they were located down in Southeastern. There was a totally different environment for them. And they were not properly treated. They made a documentary that you might have seen that's available about that whole transfer values down to that area. Quite a few died.
Where would that be, in the library here? Or?
Yes, they have, I think, a copy of it in the library. They have put it on the channel, 14, the college channel, from time to time, so they may have a copy of it too. Which gives a good history, and they interviewed some of the people that had lived during that time, and of course it's the women and the old men and the children that remember that, because the men were off and fighting and or working on these patrols and things. They felt they were more valuable to keep most of them here in the state or in the territory at the time, because they knew what their area was like.
Doug, when do you absolutely have to go?
Well, maybe the thing is just to check with the radio and see what's happening with the council meeting.
Oh, broadcast. Shall we turn the radio on to find out?
Okay, let me turn this thing off a second.